What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back, Larry Rifkin and John Kropczyk, proud products of the public education system in our state. And John, you know, there was a gentleman who wrote to us and he said, I love your podcast and I've got a topic for you, and that is the future of public education. And my first response, John, or my first way of thinking about this was, Boring.
Now, come on. This should be a very interesting looking at up at the horizon and new ways of teaching.
Yeah, but it's difficult to convey this. I'm not saying it's not an important topic. In fact, I spent an inordinate amount of time dealing with this when I programmed public television in the state of Connecticut. And I did a lot of programs about public education. And when the ratings came back the next day, they were great programs, but not a lot of people wanted to see it. They cared about it.
Right.
But how do you bring those issues to life?
Entertaining way.
Exactly. Yeah. But I'll tell you, I thought the same thing about a podcast. Then I went to a seminar, and it was conducted by a man by the name of Jonathan Costa. And he's someone who has written a book, Digital Learning for All, now. And he was just incredible. He took me from an agrarian society to an industrial society to the technological and post-technological age that we're in today. And he compelled me to think that he had the right way to describe public education, where it's been, where it is, and where it needs to go in a way that could really entertain our listeners, John.
Wow, that's good. I'm glad you got him on.
Yeah, he's great. You know, we had him right here in our studio, yep. And that is a rarity for us as well. And as someone who spent a little bit of time in public education, I was the assistant to the state commissioner here in Connecticut, and I came in from the outside. I was totally naive. I didn't know the jargon. I didn't know all the nuances of public education. And I'll be honest, even though I was there to explain it to the public because I was the assistant for communications, many times I felt left out of the conversation because it was a whole gaggle of acronyms and inside knowledge, and I didn't understand a lot of it. It took me the better part of 2 years to really feel comfortable with it.
Wow, that must have been tough. Like,
yeah, it really was. Language. When I was there taking the thoughts of somebody who had been the superintendent of schools in Philadelphia, a bright Harvard-educated educator, and there I was trying to be his spokesman, his speechwriter, and make it all feel right to me when he knew so much more about the field than I would ever know. And but we got along really well. We really did. And I loved the experience, but 2 years was enough. Honestly, John, we made a funding error in the state where we gave another $29 million to local districts because we had just changed the formula. And we had gone from $250 per student. That's what the state used to give right. The localities, all of them. It didn't matter whether they were rich or poor, whatever right, it may right. be. And then we went to a formula called the guaranteed tax base. And it was based on wealth, effort, and need. And it was one of the most complex systems you could ever imagine. And I'll never forget, it was probably my second or third day on the job. And I got a call from a reporter who said, by the way, can you explain that GTB formula to me? And John, I said to him, look, I'm going to be really honest with you. No fake news here. I'm going to have to get back to you because I don't understand it myself. And then I had to get myself.
Educators to come up with this.
Well, I know. And I had to get up to speed on this whole thing. So there's a lot about education that only educators really understand. But today, I think we do a really good job of unveiling some of the mysteries. If you've been a little confused about education, and I remember, John, when people used to call our radio show, and their point of reference anytime we were talking about education was, well, you know, when I went to school, this is what we did. And our superintendent would say, well, things have changed a little bit. And I don't think we've all kept up with some of those changes.
Plus, kids have changed now. Their attention span has changed, and the technology they're using has changed. I mean, who would have imagined?
Well, I think that's one of the points. What should we be thinking about the use of that technology within the classroom today? Is that a good or bad thing? What about going from universal access, which was the idea that every kid should be in a classroom, to the fact that we think now every kid should come out with a certain basic proficiency, and we're going to test it to a fare thee well. So there have been a lot of changes along the road, things that may have escaped those of us who went through many years ago.
Well, the testing hasn't worked out well. Remember, no school,
well, that's not,
no principal left behind?
No principal or no child. I don't know who was left behind. But, John, let's not draw conclusions until we hear from John Costa, because he will go over that. How much have we done with all this testing, and what has it proven? And then what I love about what he does, John, he describes the tensions at play in public education and how they may play out from the past to the future. So let's listen to him. I think he gives us some incredible insights as we look at the future of public education. With us here on America Trends is Jonathan Costa, and we are so fortunate that he's in our studio. And I consider him to be so expert in an understanding that he can impart about education, public education, where we've been and where we're going. And I heard Jonathan at a conference recently, and I was so impressed. I wanted to make certain that he was part of our podcast series. And Jonathan, what impressed me was the way you laid out what the expectations of the society have been on public education, and how much the schools have historically reflected America and the values we're trying to impart and the skills. Explain that and maybe get into some of the old John Dewey stuff, sure, if you will.
Well, I mean, public schools have always been a reflection of the culture and the society that created them. And the vast infrastructure of public schools that we have today are direct descendants of desire and need of our society to prepare a workforce that was standardized, routinized, and factory-based. And when child labor laws became part of our landscape, and kids that used to be in a factory or in a mill or in a mine couldn't be there, we had to do something with them and give them a basic level of citizenship, prepare them for the workforce that was around them. This became the blueprint for public schooling. And for most of the first 100 years of that, it was designed pretty much to, create a mindset among a workforce to prepare them for the kind of work they were going to do, and to sort those out who were really well suited for that life, and to bring the rest to go to higher education to be the folks that ran the factories and invented stuff to be made in the factory. So it was sort of that framework that created the infrastructure of public schools that we have today.
And you talk about it as being universal access, and we've moved on from just the access to a certain level of expectation. I know in many other cultures, they begin to sort the kids much sooner. In Great Britain and other places where you are targeted early on that you're going to be going to trade school versus higher education, how much was that a part of the American experiment?
Well, it was an unwritten part of the American experiment, but unique to American culture has always been this belief in upward mobility. Right? Anyone can pull themselves up by their bootstraps and rise to the top of the economic and social ladder. And so we always held out a belief that anyone in a public school could rise up, even though the data showed that most didn't. Most did get sorted out informally. the way that just about every other industrialized nation formally sorts them out somewhere in the middle to early high school years. There's an exam, there's a two-track or three-track system, and if you are doing well academically, you go on to university. If you don't, you go to trade or you apprentice or you get another job. And informally, that is the way it worked in the States, but we really have changed that over the last 20 years, both by necessity and design.
And when we look back at this era, and this is the era that I think many of us who are of a certain age, we were going to school, and until I started really thinking about what it was that I heard you present, I never really thought about what my experience was in this school as compared to where we are headed, and whether I was being judged or evaluated, particularly in the way that kids are today, and we'll get into that. But you also talked about the number of things that schools were expected to do. And perhaps in America, because kids were coming from all over the world up until the recent generations, where you're looking at common language, basic literacy, making certain they understood what it was to be an American. You said the ranking and sorting and conformity, which hit me. I mean, were we really trying to get people to understand this is your place and make certain that you occupy it with some sense of honesty and commitment to the cause?
Absolutely, because you know, much like if you're on a factory line, you're expected to do a certain job a certain way, we had those expectations for our citizens as well. And when we were bringing in at the height of, you know, the immigration in our country, we were enculturating many, many different, and we tried to create that common foundation of what it meant to be an American. And schools were a great place for that. So there was a common body of knowledge that we expected every student to learn, and we taught them all in the same way. And that was just part of that feeder system that we had created.
When did that system begin not to look appropriate to the digital and innovations that were taking place? When did we begin to realize that this was great for that moment in time, but it's not quite right for this moment?
Well, I think in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, there are a number of trends that are all developing and converging. You have the a real explosion culturally in the 60s and 70s where of individual expression. So, you know, you see it in the Vietnam War protests and civil rights. We have this taking of what typically was an American ideal but was never really pushed, and that was we are individuals. So we start to see this individual expression. That then is lined up with a digital revolution. So not only do we have these cultural formats where we start thinking about individual expression, we now have these digital tools that enable it. And now, in the last 10 years since the mobile revolution, sort of enable it on steroids. So we have all of these different forces. And the third one is the economic driving force. So as the digital revolution closes timelines, so as the faster you can do something, the faster you are to market, the faster you are to the information, the faster you are to anything, the better your economic opportunity. This starts to sort of accelerate the impact of the digital revolution. And we see the beginnings of automation. We see the beginnings of what used to be just mechanized labor now be replacing low-level knowledge work, and the pool of jobs available to unskilled labor, truly unskilled labor, begins to shrink. And you have all these things lining up on top of each other. And so it used to be, you know, in the 60s and 70s when I went to school, if you didn't excel academically, you knew there was going to be a blue-collar job that you could get that would support your family. And that was good for at least 50% of the economy. That percentage has shrunk by decade and continues to shrink. And in fact, all of the indications are that shrinkage will accelerate. And so the pool of kids who can get a career with an unskilled background is really diminishing rapidly. And that puts a whole new set of pressures on public school.
Policymakers, have they caught up to this in a serious way? I mean, I know there are still teachers who wrestle with the notion of how they incorporate digital technology into the classroom. And many of them are very weary of it, wondering what it replaces and what their role is as information is so readily available today. So how much dislocation has been and is going on in the typical classroom as a result of all this?
Well, I'm going to go back to your policymaker question because as early as the 80s, with the nation at risk, we see the beginnings of concern sort of bubble up, this sort of sense that the way we are educating kids is not keeping up with the demand. And so policymakers do what most adults do when their formal framework and belief is challenged. They do what they know better. So if it's not working, it must be because the thing we're doing, we're not doing well enough. So let's do more of it. So if I teach the wrong stuff longer or teach the wrong stuff better, somehow this is going to solve the problem. And the history of policymaking at the federal and state level over the last 20 or 25 years has really been to double down on the things that we always thought was the answer. So we're going to raise our standards. Well, who wouldn't want to raise standards? Of course, they should be raised. We're going to, you know, increase the school day. We're going to do year-round schooling. We're going to test everybody and test everyone more frequently. But no one has really led a national discussion about, are we doing the right thing in the first place? So it's as if, you know, you're on a cruise ship and you're talking about what the entertainment on the cruise ship is going to be and how to make the cruise experience better.
And the captain's drunk.
Right. And no one said, do you really want to be on a cruise ship? Is that really what we want to do?
Well, with all of that, I mean, what was it that we were then trying to avoid in what we saw ahead? Or did we not see that we were going, as you point out, from the desktop to the laptop to the handheld to the wearable? I mean, that this was all happening with such rapidity that you could barely catch your breath. What was it? Were we scared of that?
Well, I think the first impetus for change was simply understanding that we needed more kids to perform better. So, I mean, when you look at Nation at Risk, when you look at No Child Left Behind, you sort of see a nation recognizing that you can't afford to lose kids. You've got to challenge yourself to educate all kids. And that is an important, thoughtful, and, you know, something that we should be proud of. We have taken on the burden of educating and challenging every child to be successful. The essential question should be, what does that success look like and what does that success entail? It can no longer be an accumulation of content knowledge only that is readily accessible by anyone with a digital device from anywhere at any time. It has to be a foundational set of facts and skills, absolutely, but the ability to learn in new ways, to think in new ways, to adapt, to change, to solve problems, to communicate. It's just the fundamental indicators of success of a high school graduate in 2030 cannot possibly be the same as they were in 1970 or 1980. And we really have to rethink what a successful graduate looks like before we can adjust the rest of the system.
We'll return to this episode of America Trends in just a moment. If you like what we're doing here at America Trends Podcast, please don't keep it to yourself. I know there are a lot of people, John, who think, well, if I'm listening and somebody else wants to listen at the same time, maybe we're going to collide and they're not going to be able to hear us.
Yeah.
Is that the way the technology works?
No, there's plenty of bandwidth. Everybody can listen at the same time.
All so right. Well, that sure dispels that myth. Now, you can do a number of things that would really be helpful to us. You could give us a kind rating or a review at Apple Podcasts, and that boosts what they consider to be our value and visibility. And what does that do, John?
Well, that puts us in the forefront so that you can find us easier, and most important is other people can find us easier.
And you can subscribe there or on our site, americatrendspodcast.com, or wherever you're listening, so we can alert you to new episodes of the podcast, which, by the way, we put out twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And stay in touch with us on both Facebook and Twitter at Trends Podcast. Or you can like us on Facebook or follow us where, John?
On Twitter.
On Twitter. Yeah. That's right. Where the world turns to hear fake news or whatever it is. Well,
not
you can
us,
direct
though.
Message
we
us at Trends Podcast or using hashtag Trends Podcast. And you know, John, with our growing audience, and really it's been pretty remarkable, a lot of people just came to us the last month or two and they might have missed earlier episodes. Can they get them again?
They can look through them and pick the ones they want to listen to. They're all on the website, and a lot of them are up on iTunes, many of them.
All right. Well, listen, there's lots of material to listen to. We hope you have the time, and we'll lend it to us because we try to make it worth your while. And thanks so much for listening.
And tell your friends.
We now return to this episode of America Trends. Many of the people listening to this may not have been in a classroom for a long period of time. If we walked into one today, and the last time we'd been in one was 1975 or 1984, how different would it look, and how much of what it is that we need to make certain these kids can do in terms of thinking and being aware of all the dynamics of change and the constant learning that's going to be required to be successful? How much of that is being built into the curriculum?
Well, unfortunately, if you went into many classrooms, it wouldn't seem different at all. And I think that's part of our challenge. You can go into some classrooms and have it look quite a bit different. I mean, at my organization, my agency, Ed Advance in Litchfield, we have a program called Skills 21. We've written, through the help of the National Science Foundation and the United States Department of Education, through funding, we have 31 different high school courses. Each course has a built-in challenge based on the content in the course, where kids have to form project teams, solve the problem. If it is a viable solution, plan to bring the project to market. I mean, so if you get in the right place, in the right school, with the right leadership, it'll look very different from the way it used to look. Our challenge is, how do we bring that experience to every kid and give everyone the chance? Because right now, it's a hit and miss landscape, based on where you are, what community you're in, the leadership in the district. And we just need to make it more consistent, more widespread, and supported by policy. Because I think in many cases, districts who are doing this well, teachers who are doing this well, schools who are doing this well, are doing it despite the policy environment, not because of the policy environment. And that's what has to change.
I think what most of us on the outside of the educational system have learned over the years is that there's a lot of expectations now. Kids are being challenged and tested, and teachers, in part, are being evaluated based on that testing. So we hear a lot about the testing regimens that have been built. To what end thus far?
I mean, the challenge is, The new Smarter Balance assessment that was so much in the news a year or so ago was absolutely a step in the right direction.
And explain what that is.
The Smarter Balance was a multi-state collaborative new assessment that was designed to be aligned with the Common Core standards, which were also voluntarily adopted by a consortium of states. And it attempts to bring more problem solving, more critical thinking to the testing environment. And it is a step in the right direction. It's taken electronically. There's no more pen and pencil. The challenge is, it is a step in the right direction. It's not the answer. And the challenge is, all of the things that people really believe are the most important things are really hard to assess in a manner that we are used to talking about assessments. So if I had a group of adults, I could immediately assess their knowledge of 50 state capitals, and I could do it with 100% accuracy in a very short amount of time. If I wanted to ask them to think critically about why their state's capital was in fact the capital, and was it a good decision, and is there a better capital, and make an argument for that, we would all recognize that that thinking and that ability to articulate that thinking is probably more important than your knowledge of the 50 capitals. But there might be 20 different opinions as to how well that argument was actually made. And it's just a harder thing to assess. So what I find a challenge in the assessment argument is people often want, or people will have perfect be the enemy of good. If it's not 100% reliable, we can't use it. Well, if I give you 100% reliable feedback on something that's meaningless, is that actually better than fairly reliable feedback on something that's really going to help you? And that's a struggle right now.
What are the expectations on teachers these days? Who are they in this new world of anytime, anywhere information and its availability? What role are they meant to play today? How different is it than when they were really giving out information that was unavailable to us generally?
I mean, it really depends on the teacher, the prep program they went through. But, you know, we used to have a saying about if you put a good person in a bad system, eventually the bad system is going to win, because you have teachers who are now being brought up in a digital age, are totally comfortable with all of this technology, but they get to their classroom and all the kids don't have devices. Sometimes the teachers don't have devices. They still have the same curriculum. They still have the same assessments. They still have the same test. They have a teacher evaluation process that is overburdened, meaning too many indicators, too few people to do the evaluations themselves. So, I mean, as I said a few minutes ago, people who are doing it well are doing it despite the system, not because of the system, and that's not sustainable because they give so much of themselves. It's a price that very few can sustain because it's hard work.
I know that we will get into some of the tensions that you think we have in our public education system these days. But I do want to get at one, which is local determination. That has been such a key to the American system. Many other countries, of course, national standards are nothing new. We've seen a lot of these evaluations of how American kids do vis-a-vis the rest of the world. Help us understand this construct and the role of the local board of education, state education agencies, and the federal government at this moment in time.
Well, this is a great segue into those tensions because this is one of them. I mean, every other country that we compete against and are often held up against have national curricula, national standards, all of that. We have 50 different state approaches, and in Connecticut, 169 different local approaches. Local control is a terrible and awesome thing. So you get the right superintendent, the right board, the right leadership all working together. They can transform local education and make it brilliant. Any one of those factors falls apart and you get nothing. So there are examples where strong federal control and state control can make a difference. There are examples where good local leadership can make a difference, but it can go the other way too. And there's no one answer. But I mean, No Child Left Behind was an attempt at the federal level to bring higher standards to all 50 states. And there was pushback and challenge. And it didn't go particularly well because I think it was based on a flawed outcome. But it has changed the way we think about educating every child, and to that degree it was important. But at some level, we need a statewide discussion about what a successful graduate should look like in 2030 or 2040, and then have local boards work to try to make that happen. We could do another podcast on the impact of local control on budgets and facilities, and can we sustain it? I mean, I have school districts in my service region with less than 100 kids. At some level, it's not.
Yeah, there isn't critical mass. Yeah. But how unfair is it to ask a local Board of Education member, a parent, a former teacher, a business person sitting there to try to understand these changes that are coming at us so quickly? And that's another thing that you did in your presentation, to collapse the timeline of change. And I think that's really important because the educational system is trying to keep up with that, and it seems near impossible.
It is. It is very challenging, and I find it an interesting thing to watch, because many of the wonderful people who give of their time and run and serve on local boards of ed are dealing with these technology changes in their livelihoods, in their work, and in their professions. But the pull of memory of what school was like when you were in school is such that very often those lessons learned from their daily professional lives don't filter into their policymaking when it comes to school governance. And you know, that just takes time to work through. And so often the local politics of boards of ed drive people to the center. They're just trying to do their best. And I don't blame them. I don't fault them. I honor those people for giving of their time. I'm a 6-year local Board of Ed survivor, so I know what it's like. But it's a lot to expect, especially from 169 different elected bodies in a state as small as Connecticut.
And how many of them are run over by a lot of the jargon that comes into the educational conversation? Because I know that that is something that I often get overwhelmed with. And I was in the educational sphere for 2 years as an assistant to our state commissioner of education. Coming from the outside, I really had to get up on this. So how much are they trying to keep up with something that's hard to understand and kept a mystery in many ways because of the way that educators want to consider themselves separate and apart?
Sure, and it's no different from any other profession. I do think it gets to be a little challenging in education. We love to call things by names that no one would recognize. And you know, if you stay around long enough, you and I have been in this business a long time, you will find the same thing called by something else. Just 20 years later, it's the exact same. You mentioned Dewey, 20 minutes ago. Very few of the things that we advocate kids do were not recognized as important by him 120 years ago. You know, so we insulate ourselves in the vocabulary to make it look like we know more than we probably do, and that is an interesting barrier, and it should be eliminated. We used to have a thing called when we wrote school documents, you know, this is the 7-Eleven test. Take it down, show it to the first person who walks through that door, and if they can't understand it, you need to go back and rewrite it because it's not going to help you.
Well, also, there's a lot of changes. Whenever a superintendent changes, they haven't yet implemented their reform plan altogether, but they've gotten on this revolving carousel, and they're off to the next district before there's been any proving of what they've done. And then somebody else comes in and says, well, I've got to legitimize my ascendance to this office, so I'm going to gut and change everything. Is there that? Because we hear No Child Left Behind, Smarter Balanced Assessment, Common Core. Those of us out here, we don't even know how anybody understands whether they're on foot or horseback within a school system.
Yeah, I mean, that is a fair assessment. You know, superintendent tenure is usually based on, you know, just trying to aggravate the smallest number of people that you can, because eventually if you change things enough, you will aggravate enough people who are used to it being the way it was that they will ask you to go. So there is a tension in that as well. And that's why I think the conversation about what a successful graduate looks like needs to be broader than it is now on a community by community basis. Because if we had it on a statewide basis, for example, I think folks could look at that and use it as a touchstone to say, listen, we're trying to create a statewide environment that drives toward this vision of student success, which is skill-based and competency-based. And so I think that would be a productive...
By the way, I didn't ask you, when we look at all the testing that has become now, we've gone from universal access to what we consider universal proficiency. What have the results been of all this testing, even if we're not testing for quite the right things or can't keep up with all the changes that we should be trying to, as best we can, account for going forward? What has the result looked like in public education?
I mean, there have been marginal improvements, but in general, student performance on standardized tests has been pretty consistent, up a little, down a little. There has been no dramatic spikes upward. We do see that more kids take the tests now than ever before, and you have to figure that in. You have to give people credit. You know, back when I was in school, not everybody was tested. And so it was easy to hide kids who weren't performing because they weren't tested. We do now test everybody, so the testing pool is larger. But in general, we have squeezed a lot out of the system we have. The question is that the system you need to get you to the next generation of learning, the next generation of student success?
In your mind, what does thinking for the information age really look like? I mean, you've seen it, I'm sure, because you've been around this educational establishment for a long time. When you see it, what does it look like, and how different does it look from that which we might recognize?
Well, I think it's it is allowing the learner to learn and develop their own expertise and build their own framework for success. People often confuse what I just said with, we just let kids do whatever they want. You can't ever take rigor and hard work out of the equation. Learning is hard work, and it needs to be rigorous. We need to have high standards. But to think that rigor is learning everything versus learning a few things well is the difference, because we know that these kids are going to be in jobs that are much different than the ones we have now, are going to be in jobs that don't exist now, that most of what they will need in their professional careers, they will learn during their professional careers. So we need to prepare them for learning, not prepare them for status quo. And so, you know, what is that foundational set of factual knowledge that you need to be an American citizen? Absolutely still critical. Literacy, math at a foundational level, and then pick the pathway to master. What will you become fluent in? What will you become a mastery learner of? And pursue that, and use that to build the foundation that you can go forward through. I mean, the other big change is, you know, we always used to ask kids, what are you going to do when you grow up? And we try to say, what are you going to do first? Because it's almost incomprehensible that any kid is going to graduate from college or graduate from high school and just do one thing. It's just, things are changing so quickly. Everyone's going to have multiple careers. So don't put all that pressure on a kid. Just say, what are you going to do first? What skill set will you have? And where do you think, what direction do you think you want
to go?
And
very briefly, take us through that time span between upheavals. We're talking about the agricultural revolution, industrial, and the like. I mean, just to give us a framework for what you're describing.
Yeah, I took I referenced in the presentation I gave that to you that day, a wonderful book by Yuval Harari, and he talks about the sort of pancaking of these really challenging societal transformations and how there used to be thousands or hundreds of years between them, so we all got used to them. And the first couple were both agricultural. You sort of, you know, the human beings stopped moving, they planted things, and then many thousands of years later would grow enough stuff to allow others to not plan anything. But if you look at the last 300 years, so you have the introduction of, you know, steam and mechanized labor, and 150 years later, a digital revolution, 30 years after that, a mobile revolution, 10 years after that, you know, artificial intelligence, algorithms, and so these truly disruptive transformations coming closer and closer together, making it harder and harder for us to get our bearings about how this is changing our lives. And we previewed a couple. So, you know, millions of people in this country are employed getting products from one place to another. And we're on the verge of
eliminating
those jobs. And what are the impacts of those changes? You know, a shortage of organs for transplant. Where's that come from? Fewer car accidents, fewer fatalities because machines don't have accidents as frequently as human beings do. So there will be more disruptions to come. And I'm not sure if we have a policy environment, not only in education, but in Congress and the legislature, that's really adaptive enough to think it through at the level we need to stay productive. So there are many, many challenges.
And some would argue that the educational system seems to be one of the more static systems over the years.
Absolutely.
Well, let's go into some of the titanic tensions. I want to leave the audience thinking about these because I think they'll recognize them in their own communities. You talk first about the uncertainty of the future that we just heard you describe versus the illusionary security of the past. When I was a radio host, I would hear from people all the time who had not been in a classroom for the longest stretch. Oh, you know, in my day, this is the way we did it. And they're holding on to that, thinking that if only there was more discipline, if only there was more of a, you know, we're going to impart and download and you're just going to receive. That's what they think was necessary. But you make us understand that perhaps is really just a relic of the past.
Well, I have never seen it, and I don't think anyone in history has ever seen it actually work. I mean, you know, Socrates was talking about how the generation that followed him was the end of civilization as he knew it. We always tend to believe that the way we did it was better, and the answer is not to try to adapt to what's happening, but to go back to what happened. And it just doesn't. You can't cherry pick history like that. We are at a different place. We see ourselves differently. We have a different set of cultural understandings and cultural sensitivities. You have to build a future based on that. You can't go back.
Another titanic tension that you point to is hard work, effort, and discipline. Now, this sounds like some of the old timers saying this, but that's really not what you're talking about. You're saying that's always going to be in vogue. But now we have the sense that everything will be convenient, easy, at our fingertips, and we don't really need to acquire a lot of information or begin to figure out what our role is. We just kind of take it from the geniuses who built all this technology.
Right. I mean, there's one of the challenges in this is that shift from how do we define rigor? We used to define rigor by how much you learned versus how well you learned it or how hard is it to be successful. And I often see educators who are sort of wish or hope that kids would be more persistent, be harder working, and that's all well and good, but then we want them to be persistent and harder working on things that no kid sees as being relevant to their future. So yes, we want things to be easy and convenient, and the consumer culture points us to that, but really smart people worked really hard to create those conveniences. So how do we get kids to be motivated to learn how to do those things without trying to burden them with doing things that aren't going to help them get there? And it's a hard thing to untangle, but I see that play out all the time.
going forward in public education. Jonathan Costa also sees that we're going to have this tension between membership in a community and my own individual wants and needs. What's the tug and pull here?
Well, in order to move forward as a school system, as a town, as a state, you have to work together to make that happen. It's public education is a collective act. It happens at the school level, at the district level, and it does happen in Connecticut at the state level as well. But we are so focused on what we want to do individually, from the way that the electronic communications enable that to happen, our belief that finding your own pathway forward as a learner is the best way. Where is the balance between that community responsibility of doing things together and that individual sweet spot of, you know, I can control my own destiny enough to keep me interested and keep me motivated, but I am still part of this larger thing that helps enable it. Very few people are truly successful on their own. They do it by working together and by making contributions and getting help. Where is that balance? Because there are tensions on both sides.
Another tension that we did describe was the local control and the cost burden versus giving it up to a regional source or even national. And a lot of the educators really bristle at the notion that these national standards are something that have to apply to them. Where do you see that going, that battle?
We're in a bit of a retreat from national standards, both because the air sort of went out of the Common Core balloon. You don't hear a lot about it, although most states in New England are still pursuing it. But the lack of a strong federal presence in education since the election has sort of created an environment where it's a little bit more passive at the federal level. States can do more of what they want, and in the end, locals can do more of what they want as well, which can be a good thing if what they want is to move forward, but it can also be a challenging thing if what they want is to go back to what they think they want, which is the past, and I think that just sort of is taking them in the wrong direction. But the challenge for us in Connecticut is we do have a shrinking population, we have declining enrollment, and the way we've organized governance of public schools in Connecticut is wildly inefficient, and almost nobody else does it this way, and I think it's really hard to defend it on a resource basis. We could easily have communities working together on behalf of their kids versus working alone in small pockets on behalf of their kids.
I haven't brought this up, and there's so many issues that with Jonathan Costa we have not been able to get into, but we wanted to give you a sweep in terms of public education. But I do have to ask in closing about the various forms of delivery that have been built. Lots of people talking about homeschooling, others talking about charter schools, school choice. Is in any of that constellation a silver bullet or an opportunity really to invent what it is that we have to do in order to have a productive and future-focused public education system? Or really, do we have to try a lot of different things over a long sweep of time? Is there anything in any of that that you've seen thus far that gives you hope?
Well, I think one of the challenges is that if you're doing charters and homeschooling and magnets all to do the same thing, you know, are those different models just simply polishing the wrong stone? Or are you going to have a magnet or a charter that truly tries to build a alternative vision of what success looks like for a student in 2030 or 2040? So, I mean, I think that's the challenge. So don't try to innovate new models to do the old thing. We need some policy support for innovating new models to do a new thing. And I'm convinced, and I know there are examples of it, where those new models to help kids build the skill sets that they need to be successful in the future will bear fruit and will help kids be more successful, but we just have to have it on a much broader scale. So don't innovate to do what you used to do. Innovate to do something new that's aligned with where we know this is headed.
And in closing, what are the incentives for all of this change to occur? Is it that you're not going to get funded? Is that an incentive? Is it that your evaluation and your own professional success will be built upon that? What are the imperatives to really make the dramatic changes and continually reinventing the way you're delivering content and what your expectations are for the successful child becoming the successful adult in the year 2030 or 2040?
Well, I don't think there are any incentives right now built into the system. But I think there is incentive built into our motivation as educators. A very wise educator who was influential in my early career told me, you know, Jonathan, every parent wants two things. They want to know their child is safe, and they want to know their child is being well prepared. Safety is the non-negotiable, but what it means to be well prepared is a really interesting question. And I think if we challenge ourselves to be honest about what it means to be well prepared in 2030 or 2040, and we do it as a community, we engage parents, we engage policymakers, we start making hard choices about what that preparation looks like, then that vision of a successful graduate will tumble down through policy, through practice, and help to remake our schools. But it's all founded on our common motivation to do what's best for kids. Everybody wants to do what's best for kids. We just have to be really honest with ourselves about what the answer to that question looks like.
Jonathan Costa, thank you so much for coming by today. He's the author of the book Digital Learning for All Now, A School Leader's Guide for One-to-One on Budget. And again, I can't thank you enough for walking us through what really is the entire lapsed history of public education in America and where it's headed. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for asking.